This is WILD Boston. It's now time for an in-depth discussion on today's issues and events that reflect the concerns of our community. Welcome to the In Unison program, Boston's urban talk show. Here's your host, Paula Robinson.
Hello, my name is Paula Robinson. Welcome. It's the mission of WILD to provide a distinctive brand of entertaining radio that inspires the soul, celebrates our legacy, and affirms our brilliance to live a better tomorrow today. The In Unison Show is a public service that WILD uses to keep its audience aware by creating a forum for public response to issues which directly affect the lives of our listeners. Today's guest, Julie Patricia Winch, who is a historian and writer. Her publications include Philadelphia's Black Elite. What is that, Claymore?
Cyprian Clay Morgan.
Okay, James Fortin, a biography, which we'll be talking about today, and Joseph Wilson's sketches of the higher classes of color society in Philadelphia. Now, Julie, you were also on the recent Channel 2 series, Africans in America,
mm-hmm.
Am I right?
Yeah.
Okay, and today you're going to be talking about an African-American sailor, one half century at sea.
Yeah, this is a young man who served on the Constitution as well as on a number of other vessels and was at sea for the best part of 50 years.
Now, Julia, James Fortin, who was born in 1776, he died in 1812, and he made a fortune in sailmaking.
Mm-hmm.
He was 75 years old when he passed away. What's unusual about that is the time.
Yeah.
The Emancipation Proclamation had not happened
until 20 years after his death.
Okay.
Yeah, this is a guy who has what, by any standards, is a remarkable career. He's born free into a relatively poor family in Philadelphia. His father was an African-American craftsman who was free from birth, but couldn't leave his children very much. He didn't have very much to leave, but he did leave them their freedom.
Yeah.
And Fortin goes on from strength to strength.
I always have trouble with dates and times and places, so I'm going to ask you to help me set the scenario.
Yeah.
Slavery is going on in the United States.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's really going on at full force during his lifetime.
Yeah.
Second half of the evolution.
Yeah.
There, in Philadelphia, it's a Quakers community, basically.
The Quakers are still very strong, but they're losing power. And they've already started to move against slavery. They've already freed their slaves. But, you know, there are plenty of other people in Philadelphia who do not feel bound in the same way, and they just carry on using their slaves as they had done, as their children had done before them.
Okay. And here you have a gentleman.
Yeah.
Who was born in poverty.
Yeah.
Who learns the craft of sailmaking from his father.
Yeah. And he's in the right place at the right time. When he was born, though, he would have been very unusual in Philadelphia. Most African-Americans in Philadelphia were slaves. And his family was probably one of a couple dozen in the city that was free. The big break for him, in a sense, is the American Revolution. And he is tremendously patriotic. He really feels that the revolution includes him.
Okay, now, how old was he during the American Revolution?
When he goes to sea during the revolution, he's 14 years old.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay, and so why was this a big break for him?
Well, it's a break in several respects. He does get experience at sea, and that would be vitally important later on when he's making sails, to know how the sails actually worked. And he also sees a wider world, although it almost kills him, because, you know, this is wartime. He could have got killed just as easily as anybody else. He's actually taken prisoner by the British at one point, and he was terrified at the thought that they might sell him into slavery. And this was a freeborn man. And eventually he manages to get back to his hometown, goes to sea again when the war is over, comes back home, starts an apprenticeship as a sailmaker, and just goes on making money.
Okay, now take me through this a little slower. About how old was he when he got home?
When he gets home, he is 15 and a half years old. He's lost all his hair. He got scurvy as a prisoner of the British. He was in pretty bad shape by the time he got home.
Okay, and what could possibly make him get back on the boat to go back to sea?
Well, the war was over, and, you know, He needed the money. His family needed the money. And the money is
so he went back as a working class.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what position did he have? I take it was a job. At that point, he didn't own anything.
No, at that stage, he's just an ordinary sailor.
Mm-hmm.
And off he goes to England.
But this is not for the military?
No, he just goes off because trade is good. He can get on a ship. He can get paid.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes across the Atlantic, and he decides to stay a while in England.
And how much money are sailors making during that period?
Oh, this stage, it's a little difficult to say. I mean, it's not a great deal, but it's better than a lot of land-based trades.
Mm-hmm.
You know, particularly if you're not running the trade, you're just an ordinary worker.
Okay, so it's basically enough to sort of, not enough to send necessarily home to support his family?
Well, this is probably what he was doing. He's got a widowed mother. He's got a sister. Probably before the voyage, he was able to sign over quite a bit of his pay to them. And he seems to be very close to his family. And providing decently for them is something you see right through his life that matters to him tremendously.
Okay, now he decides to stay in England.
For a year.
And what makes him decide to stay in England?
Absolutely no idea. I mean, is this adventure? Is it that he likes it there? It can't be that he likes the cooking. But he stays for a year, and then he decides it's time to come back home. You know, maybe this was his one little chance to see a wider world. Comes back home, gets an apprenticeship as a sailmaker, and eventually takes over the business.
Okay, now, in terms of craftsmanship while he was there,
mm-hmm.
or the trade while he was in England, do you know what he did?
We don't really know, but I would suspect that he already knows some of the details of sailmaking, and there was a big demand in England for people with experience in trades like shipbuilding, sailmaking. I don't think he would have been doing unskilled work for very long. I think someone would quickly have offered him a job.
Okay, and the theme now England was going through a very, they were going through a slightly different period of time. Slavery wasn't as...
Well...
Is breach? Is that a word?
It was certainly going on in England's colonies.
Uh-huh.
And it was still legal in London at the time he was there. I mean, he would have had to watch his back.
Uh-huh.
But he would also have run into, in a large international seaport, he would have met men who were sailors from all over Africa. He would have met people from the West Indies. He'd have met people from North America like himself. It was a very diverse community.
Okay. Now, for those of you who have just tuned in, we're talking with Julie Winch. She is talking about an African-American sailor's half century at sea. It's about this gentleman, James Fortin, who was a sailmaker. He was born in 1776. He died in 1842. He lived 75 years. And he became extremely wealthy at sailmaking. And so we basically want to introduce you to the different kinds of things that were happening as we move toward Black History Month. So he's back in America.
Yeah.
After his trip from England.
Yeah.
All right.
Gets a chance really to master a skilled trade. And this is what he proceeds to do. And in time, he rises up through the ranks in the sail loft where he's working from apprentice to foreman to junior partner and eventually to senior partner.
Now, the company that he was working with had to be very good to him. Was this all with one company?
Yeah, it was one man who had, it had actually employed his father as well and seemed to like him and had bigger plans for his own children. So his business he was quite willing to make over to his trusted foreman and junior partner. And also give him those introductions that would have been crucial, you know, to sea captains, to merchants, you know, help him to broker his way through the business community.
Right. And that was something that I can remember actually my father doing. My father was a musician,
mm-hmm.
very, very different period of time. But when he bought a restaurant, one of the things he had to do was to pretend he was actually the employee of the restaurant
mm-hmm.
and have other people sort of introduce him and have people get to know him over a period of time before he could actually admit that he was the owner. That was the climate of the times.
Yeah.
Okay, we've sort of traveled with James Fortune through his life a little bit. Okay, and now he's back in the United States.
Yeah.
And he's working as a sailmaker. How long did he work for the company before he actually took over?
He's there for about, about 10 years before he takes over.
Okay, and that would make him about...
He's in his mid-30s.
He's in his mid-30s now. Okay, and so... What are some of the things that begin to happen?
Well, he learns a lot about the world of business. I mean, this guy diversifies his investments. He starts buying up real estate. He starts making loans. And he starts emerging as a prominent figure in the African-American community. He's, in fact, the Grand Master of the African Masonic Lodge. But he's also getting very involved in the movement to suppress slavery. I mean, this is something he would never turn his back on in the whole of his lifetime. And he put a lot of his money into fighting for the abolitionist movement.
Can I ask you an aside? One of the things that I've been talking to folks about with the new technology is documenting their families. What was it like for you as an author?
Yeah.
To do the research and to do the digging for the history on James Fortune.
Well, it's sometimes been frustrating, but most of the time has been fascinating. You start poking around and all sorts of stuff comes out. You find the documents to reconstruct the family. Sometimes it's just a little scrap of information that gives you the clue to go on to something else and, you know, leads you to the next step. So it's really a quest that's taken me to Canada, backwards and forwards to Washington, to Charleston, South Carolina, to London, and backwards and forwards to Philadelphia.
Basically all the places that James Fortune went.
Yeah, and some of the places that that he never went, but records surfaced about him there.
Okay. And so and how long did it take you to put this piece together?
Oh, I would say I've been working on the biography of this man for the best part of 15 years.
Okay. And so just to give folks an idea of how long it takes to begin to put together a biographical sketch on family members.
Yeah.
So my thrust for this was going into looking at the background of James Fortune and comparing it to the stories of the family members that we have who are still living.
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier if you have a family member
who's still living, then you can start to see what they know. Because sometimes they embellish it a bit, or they forget things, or they get things slightly wrong. And, you know, I would say once you start doing any kind of family investigation, especially if it's your own, you better be prepared for whatever you'll find. Now, I should admit here that I discovered looking around at my own family that I had an uncle who was a bigamist.
Those are the kinds of things. I sat down in a conversation one time with a couple of friends of mine, and we started talking about our family members, and we realized we had more in common when we first sat down. What kinds of places do you begin to do the search?
I guess one of the best places to start off, if you're doing a figure like this where you don't have surviving family members, is to start looking at the census. And the census was taken every 10 years beginning in 1790. And you get little bits of information that help you put the family together from that.
Okay, and so what do you look for in a census?
Well, you start to look for names. You start to look for addresses. You can find ages. Now, sometimes these are a little off. You can start to find in some of the later censuses, they'll actually note what the relationship is of one person to another. So you could find out, say, somebody's got a widowed sister who's living in the family, or somebody's got a boarder who's living there. They'll start to note that down. So it gives you some sense of who are the people who are living in this household.
Okay, now for black people it's particularly difficult because their family genealogy isn't necessarily written down. I mean, the ethnicity was all, at that time, was it Negro?
Well, the census taker was given three categories. White, as a W, B for black, and M for mulatto. And it was entirely up to him, and all these are white census takers, as to how he noted people down. It's a tendency, the census taker, if people are rich, he notes them down either as white or as mulatto.
Okay, and I can imagine, there was a whole lot of things going on with scientists and their research in terms of interpreting, so we're not even going to go there for this last few minutes of the show. Okay, but, all right, so then okay, once you go to the census, mm-hmm. then where can you go?
Then you can usually go to city directories, which were the forerunners of today's phone book.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a little more information, perhaps, about the careers of different people. They'll know the person's name and address and whatever their occupation is.
And so where would you find
those? You would go to, for Boston, you would go to the Boston Public Library. Microtext department. And in fact, they have there all the city directories that were published in the United States, from the earliest ones, which are just after the Revolution, to as late as they're published, you know, around 1900, 1905, till the phone books take over. You just go and you tell them the city that you want, and they get you set up on a microfilm reader.
And I have to ask you about money.
Mm-hmm.
How much over 15 years? First of all, how many hours a day did you spend doing this?
Oh, my goodness. It would work out if I were paid by the hour. I'd have been earning something like 35 cents an hour. But you do other projects along the way.
Right. So this is definitely something that you have to do out of love.
Yeah. You don't do this if you're not fascinated by it.
Right. And how many hours, how many man hours would you say?
Oh.
Over the course of 1 year.
I wouldn't even
average,
like
can
to
you average maybe a month or break it down into a...
Oh.
Is it a 20 or 40-hour week?
It's a 40-hour week, yeah.
Yeah.
And you also rely on friends in other cities. You send them data. They're researching people. You find a little something that's useful to them. They say, you know, I just found this in the archives. Knew you were researching James Fortin or somebody else. Made a copy of it for you. So there's a lot of friends out there who, you know, we all try and help each other with our various projects.
Okay. Now, how much money do you think?
Oh,
you don't even get.
I don't even want to get into that.
Okay, but it is. You have to. What kinds of things do you have to set aside money for? I should ask.
Getting to the place, staying somewhere while you're there. Photocopies. Sometimes you have to pay for stuff to be microfilmed. Just a lot of time.
Some of that's saved now. Some of that's saved now because of computers.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is wonderful that you have the internet. You can access some of the databases that are out there. And you don't actually have to go to places. And I went all the way to Canada for one particular record and then discovered I could have got it in Boston.
Okay. We have a caller on the line, Calvin from Mattapan.
Hi.
Hello, Calvin. Welcome to In Unison. You have a question or comment for Julie?
No, I just wanted to call and say that I took a class from Ms. Wench about a year ago at UMass, and I'm enrolling in a class tomorrow.
Is this Calvin Durham?
4 o'clock. Hi.
Hi, Calvin. How you doing?
Good, and you? It's good to be in your area.
Saw your name on the roster, and I'm glad you'll be with me for this class as well.
Right. Okay, but I just wanted the audience to know that Ms. Wench has a very vast knowledge of black history, and if anyone is interested in taking the class in black history, definitely take it from Ms. Wench.
Now, Calvin, I have to ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go to Ms. Wench's class to learn how to search your family tree?
No, I didn't.
Basically, yours was for an education around black history in general. Okay. Well, thank you for calling.
See you tomorrow, Calvin.
Okay, I'll see you tomorrow.
Classes
start tomorrow.
For those of you who haven't guessed, Ms. Wench teaches at UMass Boston. Okay, now, let's just one more question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When you're doing a search of this magnitude,
mm-hmm.
okay, what kinds of unexpected things did you come across?
Oh, gee, the number of unexpected things I came across, I just couldn't even begin to count. It's taken me in unusual directions. I didn't know that I'd actually have to go to sea in order to try to understand this man's life, nor did I know that I'd have to try to learn sailmaking, and I still have the scars to prove it. I had to get out there and do this to try to get any sense of how this man made his money.
Okay, now the curious thing about this is James Fortin is not that unusual a name.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose his name had been more like mine, Robinson.
Yeah, then you've got some difficulties. And, you know, one of the things I looked at is when the census taker or whoever's doing the recording hears a name and he writes it down as he thinks it's spelled.
Ah.
Yeah, I was...
So then the spellings are...
Yeah. I was looking at one guy who... I've been doing some work on St. Louis as well. And an African-American man just out of slavery, his last name was Helms, came to St. Louis to get married. And this was a Frenchman who was taking down the name, and he wrote it down not as Helms, but as Allums.
Oh,
yeah, A-L-L-O-M-S.
That's interesting. Yeah. So, with James Fortin, when you find similar names, how do you know which one is correct? What are the kinds of nuances that you
just have to look for as much background information as you can, and sometimes you're never quite sure. You know, it maybe it's a relative, maybe it's not.
So you sort of hang on to that information until you have other things.
Yeah, and then maybe, exactly, maybe another clue surfaces later on.
So how much side paper do you have on just all kinds of other things?
Oh, let's see. I've got a book I've got coming out in June on the African-American community of St. Louis before the Civil War. I've got another book I'm doing on a guy who was part African-American, part Irish, who wrote about Philadelphia, in the period before the Civil War. So all sorts of bits and pieces, all sorts of projects that are always out there, and some you say you go back to and you don't for years, and others you just start pursuing them and, you know, get them to a publisher and hope they'll accept the book.
Okay, and what actually introduced you to your love of Black history?
Oh, pure accident. Interested in American history from the time I was at university in England, and it seemed to me that the liveliest, the most exciting area was Black history.
And why was this lively and exciting?
I think because people were starting to look again at sources and see what they could bring out, you know, to try to overturn this idea that there wasn't a history there worth pursuing.
Mm-hmm. I see. And you have gone on to prove them wrong,
mm-hmm.
as with others. Okay, well, I'd like to thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank
for those
you.
Of you just tuning in, I've been talking with Julie Winch, speaking on the sailmaker James Fortin, who lived from 1776 to 1842. For more information, Julie, you have an email for those who want to reach
uh-huh.
you.
It's julie.winch, that's W-I-N-C-H, at umb.edu. And I promise I will reply.
Okay, and do that one more time, Julie.
Yeah, it's julie.winch at umb.edu. EDU.
Okay, you're listening to WILD Radio.
Contents of today's show do not necessarily reflect the views or opinion of WILD management or parent company and owner, Nash Communications.